So today is the 19th of September, and this is our second interview with Peter Letterman to record his oral history. Present here at the Chemical Heritage Foundation are David Caruso, Jody Roberts, and Sarah Hunter. And as I mentioned, I'm going to turn it over to Jody to start off today.
All right. So I want to take us back to where we were closing after the first day of interviewing with you. And what struck me in looking at my notes, there are a couple of things that I think maybe because of time we started to rush through, but I want to give you a chance to explore a little bit more. And there's a couple of different things that happened that you mentioned, and I want to see how they're connected. So maybe they're not, and you can tell me if they're not connected. But I'm going to list a couple of things, and you can either talk about them individually or tell me if they might or might not be connected. You spent a little bit of time talking about, so this is after you've transferred back to Brooklyn Polytechnic, and you talked a little bit about the change of being now back in academe, mentioned the politics of the Vietnam era, but there were also several other things that were happening that you were involved with that I think maybe could have more discussion. One of those is increasing student interest in pollution controls, and this I think you mentioned in response to the question about your involvement with the Garbage Committee in New Providence. You also became the advisor to the New York EPA. You were involved on the Solid Waste and Garbage Committee, as I just mentioned. And you also mentioned interest in putting together an NSF grant for underrepresented students for an environmental program. And I think the last piece that you also mentioned was an interest in trying to build a program within your engineering department to for the students to look at the environment as a system. And I wonder if you can, maybe that's too many things all at once, but I'm interested in, there are a couple very student and environment focused pieces. There's some that have to do with your extra, your activities outside of your job. And then also the broader cultural context. I think, you know, there are the politics of Vietnam, but there's also the politics of environmental concern and things like that.
The politics of Vietnam were really separate. I mean, I was a Naval Reserve officer. I wasn't called up. And I was at Poly, asked to head the ROTC evaluation committee, because at most campuses that was a real issue. Do we have ROTC or don't we have ROTC? There had been some demonstrations at Poly. Poly is a urban campus, and very compact at that time. There was a flag burning at the ROTC offices. Anyway, there was this whole thing, and I don't know how I got involved in that particular thing, but I did, and I chaired that committee. That's an issue that has nothing to do with anything. It was one of my academic responsibilities, if you will. The others certainly were connected. Now, whether they were overtly connected or not is, at this point in my life, hard to, you know, say. When I came to Poly, I had been doing some work in toxic materials as a side issue to my work at ESSO. I mean, it was part of my job, but it was not the main part. It was just an important thing. When I came to Poly, I, like any professor, and I came in as an associate professor, needed to find an area that one could call one's own. To do research or to do whatever. And as I mentioned, my main focus was on process design, and that was an area of expertise, but that wasn't where you could do much research, at least at that time. And it seemed to me that, this was 1967, that environment started to become an important issue. And what I saw was that it was very fragmented. So I tried to pull something together. There was another man there, Ed Ziegler, assistant professor, who was really an heir, but I wanted to do something that was holistic, if you will. Innocence, young innocence abroad, in a sense.
Why do you say that? Why do you think that was just innocence?
Well, because at that time, as I had mentioned, they were very fragmented at the federal, state, and local level. You had the sewage people were the sewage people, the garbage people were the garbage people, and air started becoming important, but it was the air people, and not quite never the twain shall meet, but they were segregated. At the federal level, they were different statutes, different agencies, reporting in different departments. So right away, and solid waste was not a federal issue, really, at that point. So that was the whole thing of bifurcation or trifurcation. I'm not sure how I got involved in the NSF grant, but we were at Poly interested in the under what do we call now? I don't want to use the word disadvantaged, but I can't think of the word right now. Underrepresented students, and this was a place where I felt there was a hot topic, and one could get NSF summer grants for things like that. I needed to have a summer job. I couldn't just live on my regular salary. So it was it worked out well, and I had a great deal of fun doing it. And I think the students benefited from it. And so it sort of was this confluence. And then in the design area, I had a couple of students who started looking at solid waste. Why? Well, they were interested. They were from areas where the garbage was just, you know, dumped. And so I had a couple of them look at what happened. And we got some senior projects out of it. So there was a confluence, but it was more serendipitous rather than knowing, you know. The EPA, New Jersey Environmental, New York Department of Environmental Protection, I'm not sure. I think they were looking for somebody, an engineer, one of their advisors, and I'm not sure whether I was volunteered or what, but it worked out that way. So it worked well. It got me into an area that was of interest. It certainly led to the rest of my career, but it was not, I would say, a planned overt move.
Well, but that's what seemed so amazing to me was that for as little attention as we gave it in the first interview towards the end there, pretty much everything that follows in your career afterwards
is based on that.
It has a pretty solid root in your experiences with solid waste.
You know, and it goes to you got to be at the right place at the right time and be lucky. I never used my PhD thesis except towards the end of my career, and it wasn't really that. I then used this liquefied natural gas, but my adsorption, the studies I did, while other people would take their research and go right into that area and stay there the rest of their lives. Different strokes for different people, and I'm not sorry it happened the way it happened. I'm not sure I can really give you more meat for that.
Yeah. Can you talk at all about the types of work that the students were doing, if you remember?
Well, let's see. I had one student who did a study on converting bagasse to ethanol. which is what the Brazilians do now, which is much better than doing quanta ethanol, by the way. And that was a master's thesis. I had one student who looked at the nature of the garbage that was collected from affluent, in quotes, versus non-affluent areas of New York, and were there differences. I don't remember what the results were of that. I don't remember, I frankly don't remember many of these, but those two I do remember, they sort of stuck out. And again, they were, and I had some people who did work in polymers. I had one person who did work in polyvinyl chloride, which had some problems with it, and were there substitutes. And of course, I had done work in polymers when I was at SO. Mm-hmm. So, but it was more general. I only had one PhD student, and he never got his PhD. I was an process and economics guy. And, this was a man who was in industry, who was worked for Allied Chemical. And he was interested in the economics of predicting what would happen economically to various processes. Mm. And he did a study with a fairly extensive study, and I think it was a good one. But one of our professors said, until you can show me that it really happened, it's not worth a PhD thing. Today, that would probably go, but then it didn't, and like many, just voted it down. By that time, I was already at EPA, and so I didn't have much faculty muscle. Mm. And I felt sorry for the guy, but I could do what I could do and not do what I could do.
So at the same time, you gave around this time you gave a lecture titled "Pollution Technology and the Public." I'm just kind of curious about the approach that you're developing during this time towards pollution, especially solid waste pollution, and this attached piece of the public. I mean, is this what role do you see for the public in thinking about these types of,
well,
sorts of topics?
And I haven't looked up that paper.
Sure.
And probably should, because it would make it a little easier for me to answer. When I was in the garbage committee in New Providence, it was obvious that recycling was something we were doing already, the Boy Scouts were doing, and it required the public to do things. Mm. And we had problems with the public in terms of incineration already at that point. A good incinerator is great, and a bad incinerator is horrible. Of course, the bad incinerators have got the length. So it was important that the public get involved and decide what should be done in terms of the control of pollution. Certainly, we weren't going to litter the streets with our garbage. And we had garbage collection, but then what do you do with it? And at that time already in New Jersey, one landfill was closed because it was polluting the Great Swamp. Mm. And this was in the early 70s. So we already felt those things, of course. Rachel Carson had been there. But I will try to look up that paper if I can find it.
You don't need to.
And see what I said.
Well, maybe we can find it better. I had a hard time locating it, but I think it's because it was a talk that you gave, and I don't know if it was published.
It probably wasn't.
So why don't you take us then into the your move to government in 72, taking up time in at the EPA, at the office in New Jersey.
Well, it was kind of interesting. The year before, I had been, one of my colleagues at SO, who I really didn't know at SO, had gone to EPA in Cincinnati and approached me whether or not I would join EPA as the head of the hazardous materials research section in Cincinnati. And I interviewed and went there and looked at it. And in the end decided not to take it for personal reasons. And for professional reasons too, because I was going to be working for two bosses, one in Washington and one in Cincinnati, in different departments. Boy, that just doesn't, I don't think that works. So I decided we weren't going to move to Cincinnati. A year later, Lou called me and said, the lab in directorship in Edison is opening up. This was the Industrial Waste Treatment Research Laboratory. Are you interested? Yes. And there was some things going on at Poly. Poly was in some financial difficulty, not unusual, but it was. And we were going to absorb NYU engineering. It's in 72. And I was up for full professor, but there was a fight whether I was going to get it or not. And so I went and interviewed for this job. Had all the half an hour interview with the director. And next 2 days later, I get called and said, you want the job. You've got to decide, because we're going to have a hiring freeze. And I said, but I can't go until the end of the semester. But it sounded interesting. It was now one agency handling all the media, and this was a director's job, which I went in as a GS-15, if you know anything. That was the most senior, at that time, was the most senior non-political appointee. There were 16, 17, 18 super grades, but they were special. You didn't normally get those. And this was one or two grades higher than I'd been offered before. It was in New Jersey, which means I didn't have to move. And I could see there were problems at Poly, so I jumped at it. And the rest was history. But but seriously, it was that sort of thing. Yeah. It was the right, I was in the right place at the right time, the right person, and made the right impression. Andy Breidenbach, who was the director of the center in Cincinnati, who I reported to, wanted somebody who had a PE and a PhD for this job. And the guy who was acting didn't have a PhD. And that, by the way, meant interesting getting into the job.
How was that?
He, by the way, ended up getting a PhD at night. So, and so I went into that job, and most of the areas I knew nothing about. I had stormwater overflow, small sewage treatment devices, mobile homes, small boats, hazardous material spills, oil spills, and part of the industrial waste. Not didn't have everything, it was kind of spread out. That's a pretty broad spectrum of things. And I knew nothing about government service. Now I'm a chemical engineer. Chemical engineer can do anything, in quotes. I learned on the job. I mean, I knew enough keep my head above water, and I had a very good staff. I really did. Very hardworking. Some of them are still friends of mine. So I spent 3 years at that.
Well, talk about the agency's 2 years old at this point.
It wasn't even 2 years old.
Still a lot of reorganizing going on. There's still a lot of consolidation of duties and different departments and
The laboratories
The
air work was principally done in Research Triangle Park. We did a little bit, but it was primarily there. The water work was headquartered in Cincinnati, the Robert Taft Center, which had done sewage work for a long time, and they also had some public health work for drinking water. And then things filled into there. And I don't know how oil spills got down to Edison, but they did. And we picked up some other stuff. And other industrial work was being, research work was being done in Oregon, Corvallis, in Duluth, Minnesota, in Ada, Oklahoma. But we were sort of, we had the title, better word. And I had a very good boss. There had already been this ingathering of the air work, which had been under the air program. The water and solid waste work had been under interior public health. And that had already been done. So the formation was there. I reported to the director of the Robert Taft Center. Later became the Andrew Breidenbach Center. I was the only lab director outside Cincinnati. The others were in Cincinnati. I also had the broadest program. We had a program on wastewater. We had a program on analytical. These are laboratories. We had one on health, or health-related things. And one other that I've forgotten. And mine. Mine was sort of the broadest. It covered a lot of sins. We actually tried to reorganize the industrial program 2 years later, and would happen, but the Speaker of the House at that time didn't want Ada, Oklahoma to be shortchanged, and so that could, you know, politics ruled the day, and that's fine. But we still continued with our work.
What were some of the big challenges you faced when you took that?
Well, there were a couple of big challenges. One, we were building a facility to test oil spill equipment. It's in New Jersey, Colts Neck. I came in when this had already been granted and was in the construction stage. There were some interesting problems. This is a swimming pool, 660 feet long by 60 foot wide by 12 foot deep, and had a wave maker at one end. That was designed by a marine engineer, and he used a motor which wasn't going to work. Fortunately, I had one course in electrical engineering, and I learned to ask the stupid question, which was, what happens to a DC motor when you're at low power, which is when you're at low rates? And, well, you don't get much power then. So we changed the controls, fortunately in time, so that we didn't waste too much money. That was one. We developed a program to identify oils, spilled oils, fingerprint them. Mm-hmm. I obviously had to work with a budget. I had another interesting problem where the Equal Opportunity Officer came in and said, "You gotta hire a black?" And I said, "I don't have black chemical engineers." And I was at Poly, which was right next to Bedford-Stuyvesant. And the black students we had were foreign, and they wouldn't qualify. So we ended up, I said, "I will give you 2 weeks' notice, any opening I have, and I will promise you I'll interview everybody." He never came up with somebody. And then I had a woman apply, and they wanted to give her a lower grade than she was entitled to. I had to fight that one personally. So I, you know, as a lab director, I did more than just the technical work. But I had fun with the technical work. And as I say, I had a good staff. The other one was we did some research. We funded some research on cleaning up riverbeds. And then we were going to do a demonstration. And we had to go to the lowest bidder. and that didn't work out very well. And they came into my office wanting twice as much money as in addition to what they originally bid. And I said, I don't have it. It's not a research project anymore. Well, you can't do it. Well, I don't have that. So they cut their bid in half right at the table. I said, well, you obviously can't do, don't know very much of doing cost estimates. And then I had to go to Milwaukee to explain why I wasn't funding this project. So, you know, a lot of the things which were not technical.
What was it like being in the broader service of government? So having transitioned from industry to academia to moving into government, how did you find that different?
You know, they all have their different problems, and they all have politics.
Yeah.
I had politics in academia, I had politics at ESSO, I had different politics. I don't know, I guess I lived with them,
yeah,
and managed through them. And I had a very understanding boss.
What was it, my maybe last question on those couple of years at EPA, at that research office, but what was it, how do you think you viewed your relationship since you were running one of the research labs in the midst of all those other, you know, kind of, I don't know, all the other fervor around the other environmental statutes, around enforcement and regulation? Do you think you were outside of a lot of that larger kind of public debate because you were just running a research lab? Or?
I was out, to a great extent, out of the debate. But there were times when we, for instance, had to go and we did work on a spill into the Potomac.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we started getting into that. I mentioned, the other day we mentioned Diamond Shamrock in New Jersey. My people were there. And, you know, I'd get questions, and you do the best you can. We didn't have all the answers. And when I was in Washington, I got even more into that sort of thing. But, you know, you handle it the best you could. You could always say, but I'm doing the research, I'm not the regulator.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to help you.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But on the whole, we were somewhat insulated from the regulatory sort of thing.
So why did you end up deciding to leave?
I went to Washington.
Uh-huh.
And I went to Washington not voluntarily. Now we are going to another reorganization. And the Industrial Waste Treatment Research Lab is now going to move to Cincinnati. If I stayed in New Jersey, the person who was my counterpart in the region, who was the person I had replaced in the first place, was not a veteran, and he would have been downgraded, and I would have gotten his job. And the regional administrator couldn't have, just didn't want that. So I could have then gone to Cincinnati, but they wanted to move somebody else to Cincinnati, get him out of Washington. This is the politics. And so I was offered a job at a GS-16, supergrade, in Washington. I either took it or I would have been out of a job. So I took it and went to Washington. And frankly, as director of the total industrial program. The problem was that as the director of the program, I had less authority than I did as a lab director. Mm-hmm. The guy, two legs up. So I had oversight responsibility, but not direct responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Spent a lot of time on congressional, you know, responses and things, and planning, but just didn't enjoy that. And so decided to look for a job. My wife hadn't moved down yet because my kids were in school. It was a very good experience in the end, in terms of getting to know another side of government and policy.
Yeah.
So I stayed a year down there and on temporary assignment for 6 months and then permanent. And I resigned and went back into industry.
You did receive the agency's Silver Medal,
Medal
for Superior Service. What was that?
Well, initially, and I'm not sure I deserved it, that's another thing, but I was part of a group. The agency was to specify under the Water Pollution Control Act hazardous substances. Had failed to do so, or didn't do, like many things, you know.
Mm.
And this was a result of the studies done by some guys on the Mississippi in New Orleans, where there was a fair amount of contamination at that time. And that was a really key study in the 70s. And so a group was charged with determining what a list of substances that would be controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the members of that group. We picked 132 substances. Those were the first ones that were in the water area were going to be regulated. And the group got the silver medal for that. So I got a silver medal.
During this time, you were also, again, I think publishing, it's hard to know whether or not they were publications or if they were...
Well, let me just clarify for
sure.
You. I have very few peer-reviewed publications,
mm-hmm.
but I did a fair amount of, you know, publishing in the... It is the popular press, mm-hmm. but the popular technical press. So you don't know. It depends.
Well, so I noticed there was the EPA research and waste treatment for watercraft, the waste oil management, treatment of industrial chemical wastes to meet the 1974 law, pollution abatement in the pharmaceutical industry,
okay.
Physical and chemical methods,
well,
a decade of water pollution
they
control.
Were probably, many of them, and I'd have to look at the list, many of them were presentations, that, and they may have been written papers also,
mm-hmm.
that were made as a result of work that the laboratory did or, you know,
and were these presentations or these papers, you mentioned that they weren't in the popular press necessarily,
no.
but...
Well, for example, I would give a paper at the American AICHE meeting or an ACS meeting
mm-hmm.
or before some public body or I would publish in chemical engineering or... In, well, I didn't publish in CEP, in the Journal for Hazardous Waste Materials, that sort of thing.
I'm just trying to understand what it is that you were trying to accomplish with these sorts of publications, right? You're saying there, I mean, some of it was based on research, right? But you're presenting some findings, but you're also,
well,
in some ways, commenting.
Right. Well, remember, I'm a lab director. And then when I was at my next job, I was technical director and vice president. They're not really sales articles in the sense that we know, but they are perspectives on policy or on things that are happening, which are important for the public to know.
Mm-hmm.
If I was talking about research, I'd be talking about research that my people did,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily I did. There were developments that were important. It's different than an academic paper in that sense.
Right. I mean, I just wanted to get the sense.
And what, was there a rhyme or reason to them? No. They were what was, you know, important at that point.
Right. It just seems to me that, at least up to this point in your career, part of what you would try to do was take the knowledge being generated in this engineering community, in this scientific community, and take that and give it to the public so that way they could better understand the relevancy.
That's probably correct.
Okay.
That's probably correct. The public being can be anywhere from the engineering community mm-hmm. to the non-technical.
Right, right. I mean, I even remember the paper we were talking about computers and chemical engineering.
Yeah, well, that was for the educational community,
right?
Really. It was, here's some work that we did in that area mm-hmm. that you guys ought to know about. This was early in the, I mean, today that paper wouldn't fly at all. It's kindergarten stuff. But mm-hmm. at that point, it was important for my fellow engineers to know that this piece of equipment exists and you could do things with it.
And I'm wondering, too, just on those publications as well, because I understand their role, especially as a lab director. You know, a lot of times you're writing, you know, in EPA newsletter, those sorts of things. I mean, you're giving updates on what's happening. And I think one of the things that stands out to me is the shift perhaps in topic between some of those papers. And I wonder if they stand in for something else. It would seem that in some of the earlier publications, the emphasis was on waste treatment, and towards the end, it's a lot more on pollution controls. And I wonder if during your time there, there was a shift in
total shift. Mm-hmm. And there was a paper I gave in St. Louis at a regional meeting. We started talking about pollution control or pollution minimization. Mm-hmm. Somewhere in my list. Remember, when EPA started out, or even before EPA, everybody was talking about end of pipe. Sewage treatment was end of pipe. You know, you collected the sewage and you treated it. And that was the whole phenomenon. You had power plants or incinerators, you incinerated the material. You made sure that you weren't putting noxious gases up, or you should have, not to put noxious gases up the stack. You know, there were already studies at that time. There was a study in Brooklyn, Long Island University, about asthma as a result of SO2 emissions, SOx emissions, and the increase in asthma and lung diseases because of that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, That was the thing. What did we do in terms of solid waste? Well, we collected it, we burned it, we buried it, but it was an end-of-pipe solution. And then in the early 80s or late summer, we started talking about minimization. Minimize what you put out. And that started the recycle movement, mm-hmm. which, by the way, and I'm sure I talked about them in some article, we did in World War II. We collected tin cans, we collected newspaper, and then everything went out, and then we started collecting. So that was the next. Now, in my article on solid waste management, which was published in 72, which was a fairly lengthy one, I already talked about recycle and waste separation and things like that.
Can you talk about...
Oh. There was this change at that point.
Can you talk about what was responsible for that change? I mean, was this a response to new statutes? Was this a response to technologies?
I think it was a response to the fact that we needed, particularly in industry, it was economically advantageous not to do end-of-pipe treatment. To minimize the waste you generate. And that started. You know, now we call it, first it was pollution prevention, waste minimization, now we call it sustainability. But really the idea is minimize the amount of waste you have to treat, because it costs you money to treat it.
So did you have a hand in any of this? Because this would be... Did you have a hand in much in this? Because this would seem to be very much in line with your own, scholarly interest back when you were still a student in terms of thinking about the economics of process and design.
Yeah. you know, I was now past my research career totally. So whatever I had, and I was, when this really got started, I was at Roy F. Weston handling other things. So did I have a hand in it? In yes and no. I certainly didn't do research in it, but some of my people certainly worked in that area. And that may not be a satisfactory answer, but that's probably as far as I can go.
All right. So then you leave EPA.
What?
So then you leave.
Well, I leave EPA, and I'm already past that in part.
Yeah.
I found a job at Research Trail as Director of Technical Development. Now, this was really the air game. Research Trail at that time was the premier air pollution control company in the country. Probably built more precipitators than anybody else at that time. let me say electrostatic precipitators. And I took that job. It was a challenging job. It was air now was my sort of third. I'd been solid air, water air. It was in New Jersey, and I was pretty well geared to staying in New Jersey. My kids were in school at that time. And it sounded like a good opportunity, and it was. And so I spent 4 years there, 3 years as technical director and the others, vice president of Control of Environmental Sciences, which was the research room. Really worrying about technical developments in air pollution control. Probably my most interesting achievement was that we had a precipitator in Wisconsin that was not working properly. And the reason it wasn't working properly, it got coal from Montana, and the coal didn't have enough sodium in it. And if you're doing electrostatic precipitation, you need sodium ions so you can collect it. And I was told, I was on a job, I think, 2 months, and I was told, we got to fix this. If we don't fix this, our business is dead. We found a way to add sodium as sodium carbonate into the flue gas, spraying it in. So we were able to operate the precipitate as well. Only one trouble we didn't think about. And we did this in 6 months. I mean, this was... and that was castigated for spending $2 million. And I said, look how much money you save. You know, and we really went at this brute force. It was one of those things either... You had to take a chance and try to do it. They used the fly ash to make cinder blocks. The only trouble is now it had sodium carbonate in it. And what happened? That meant it wasn't structurally sound with water. They finally got that solved, but at least they were able to generate power and make... keep the air within the required emission limits.
Yeah.
And I had a very interesting negotiation with the Japanese during that time.
About what?
Well, at that time the country was going to go into NOx control. And we needed technology to handle NOx. Japanese had that technology. And everybody, the two primary technologies, had already been licensed to our competitors. And so I went into the third one. And we were not number one in the list of people they were willing to talk to. We finally got to talk to them. I got that negotiation. So we were going to be the licensee. And had everything signed. They were going to come over Labor Day and sign the agreement. They had wanted, we cut down the initial fee, and it was a good deal. Except our president decided we weren't going to do this. And he made the right decision, by the way, because we're still dealing with this NOx control business. But I had the glorious task of telling the Japanese the week before they were coming over that we weren't going to go. That's very embarrassing, let me tell you. Especially after you've had this successful negotiation. Mm-hmm. So that was another interesting point in my career. Nothing technical, really.
Yeah.
I had to know the technology. And I got two nice trips to Japan.
But you found yourself in these situations often, it seems, through your career, that you had a very strong technical background, but you often found yourself in positions of trying to manage your way through crises.
Well, you know, anybody who gets into the management area is in that position, I think. That's not unusual. If you talk to any senior executive, they aren't paid to do technology. They're paid to know and know when it's wrong, but to handle the crises. I used to tell my people when I was at Weston, I don't want to hear the good news. I want to hear the bad news before it gets out. Maybe we can do something about it. The good news I'll get anyway. So and I think most managers may not say it in that way, but they certainly, I think, feel that way if they're any good.
Do you think there was anything in particular that prepared you for that?
You know, I think about that. I didn't have an MBA, obviously. I learned on the job. I lucked out. I can't tell you. But I generally landed with my on my feet. So. Yeah.
One thing that I was curious about, and I don't know if you mentioned it specifically, you started your career with an interest in being a process engineer. You, in some ways, get sort of pushed in an environmental direction, somewhat by graduate students.
Well, myself.
And yourself.
Yeah, right? I pushed it.
Well, you had mentioned that graduate students started coming to you with these issues, and you were thinking about things in those directions. So there's this shift towards the environmental, right? When you went to Cottrell, was that a conscious decision that you wanted to stay dealing with environmental issues, or was it more just, this is what I've been working on for some time. I probably couldn't get back into process stuff.
Well, let me say two things.
Mm-hmm.
I think throughout my career, process has been there.
Okay.
No, I didn't necessarily do process design,
mm-hmm.
but I certainly used process and process thinking.
Okay.
Or now we call it systems.
Systems. Yeah.
But it's in that field. When I left Washington, I left because I didn't want to be a paper pusher.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that was my job at that time. And it happened that this was a job that came up in the environmental area. At that time, I did use a headhunter, an executive search agent,
mm-hmm.
because I was already at a level where finding a job by myself was not necessarily the easiest thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to trade on my management experience as well as my technical experience.
Mm-hmm.
Going to a large petroleum company probably wouldn't have worked because they have enough people coming up the line that they, unless there was a niche there for somebody with environmental experience, that they needed, you know, couldn't fill.
Right.
You know. So, and this just came up. I mean, it was not a conscious decision to go after that particular job.
Okay.
I didn't even know it existed.
Okay. In what degree or to what degree were you and was your company also sort of responding to what was happening in the environmental arena in the government at this time? Was the company geared towards or was it capitalizing on a lot of the acts and statutes that were coming
out?
Well,
remember, Research Cottrell started as an electrostatic precipitator manufacturer. And the statutes at that time were very much, the air statutes were pollution control, particulate, and SOx primarily. Mm-hmm. And this was Cottrell's field. So, in a sense, yeah, they were responding to the demands of the regulations. They didn't do research in the sense of developing those regulations.
Yeah, I guess I was just curious whether or not they at any point were tried to be a part of the discussion about regulation as well, right? If it was
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
And but by 1976, the air regulations were pretty firm now.
Mm-hmm.
They took another, you know, drop or particulate in other emissions later on,
mm-hmm.
but certainly they were there.
Okay.
But how much of that was a response to the ability by companies like Cottrell to demonstrate that tighter controls were actually possible? You know, so how much was the ability to amend things like clean air a response to that technology?
The particulate and SOx regulations really emanated from smog in California. I mean, that's where it started.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the companies then developed technologies to do that.
Mm-hmm.
There were studies about the effect of particulate on health. There were certainly studies I mentioned on SOx on health. I think we were looking, for example, at bag houses. We hadn't done bag houses because the precipitators might not be able to handle the next lower
mm-hmm.
level. But I think they were reactive rather than proactive in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you leave Cottrell?
I left Cottrell because... Well, there were two things that happened. Cottrell was really not doing well. And that was in part because nobody was building power plants anymore. Big business was power plants. We had other businesses, too. But that was my focus and certainly the major business for Cottrell. And power plant, and if you weren't looked in at the projections in the mid-70s, power plant construction was the demand for electricity and power plants was to rise 6% per year. Well, by 1976, 77, it was down to 4%. It was going down. Two reasons. Now, you know, you have this argument today about regulation. Well, certainly then, regulation was one of the things that caused power plants not to be built. Three reasons. One, pollution control costs a lot of money. People were very much NIMBY related. So to get a permit for a power plant probably took 10 years. Well, and then there was nuclear that came in, but the permitting was really the problem. It just took too long to get permits. So, and business dried up. That was one reason. I felt my career there was probably somewhat limited. It was a good career, making good money, and I had a good group to work with. And my former boss at EPA approached me. They needed somebody at Weston to handle the hazardous material consulting firm. So I met with Roy Weston, who was the owner. It was a publicly traded, privately controlled company. Mm-hmm. And he was the founder. And I met with him, and they decided to offer me a job. And so I went over there.
So what was interesting about that job?
Well, one, I was interested in hazardous materials, so obviously it's a chemical engineering game. I thought it was, and Superfund was just passed. I mean, this was the time. So it was the hot issue. I got the job in fall. I was also interviewing for a job as the Assistant Commissioner for Science and Technology at the New Jersey DEP. This job came through first, and I took it. And then the other job came through, and I had a very mad commissioner because I said no. We're still friends, Jerry Fitzgerald English. But it just sounded like it would be interesting. I could make a contribution. I wasn't working for my former EPA boss. I was working for somebody else. Anyway, so I made that change.
So what was the tie-in to the passing of CERCLA? And were there other things that had changed also? I'm trying to pick other mile markers along the way. You know, with RCRA being passed, right, as you're doing a lot of the... But at that point...
RCRA and Superfund, which wasn't CERCLA, was the first one, were passed.
Right.
So hazardous materials became a very key issue. And I remember Roy calling me into the office and saying, you work for EPA. What do you think is going to happen? Reagan had just come in. I said, well, everything's going to go down the tubes except hazardous materials. It's just too hot an issue. I was wrong. It went down too, but for 2 years. And then it changed because Reagan politically saw that he couldn't sustain this.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to get rid of the EPA. And that's when Ann Gorsuch left. So it just felt right.
To what degree did you find that the very public disasters of the late 70s and early 80s influenced the work that you wound up doing and focusing on? I'm thinking of Love Canal in 78, the Valley of the Drums, Bhopal, which I know is not, is a big one too. I mean, how are those situations playing into, if at all, your responsibility at Weston Inc.?
Oh, well, it's interesting. I was quoted in the Wall Street Journal on Love Canal.
Oh, okay. I'd love to hear more about that too.
Well, I was asked what I thought about Love Canal, and I said, well, the company did, you know, work with the regulations the way they were when they did this. And so I don't think they're responsible.
Hmm.
I didn't think, you know, the RCRA law is one of the interesting laws, and that's post facto. You know, just because you did it before 76, the law still applies, and you're it, which is not really according to the Constitution, but be that as it may. But certainly that increased the awareness of everybody of these problems,
mm-hmm.
and meant that that was going to be a lightning rod. Whether it was in New Jersey or wherever,
mm-hmm.
Valley of the Drums was not the only Valley of the Drums.
Right.
There were others around. And so it certainly made for a good business opportunity.
So what is it that you wound up doing in your position?
I did two things. I headed the hazardous material consulting operation, which had been part of solid waste, solid and hazardous waste, and we separated that. And I had a colleague who then took much of that over, but I still provide leadership. And I also handled the Weston had not done much government contracting. They'd been embroiled in the 70s in providing consulting to EPA on some industrial pollution standards. And there was a decision made, we will never get into the regulatory arena again. But there was a major contract to provide technical assistance to the EPA for emergency response. Mm-hmm. And we bid on that night. It was responsible for that. And then responsible pretty well for all the government contracting that we did. At the time, Weston was a $16 million a year company, and that contract was worth $8 million. So I really, at that point, was a manager or executive in every sense. I mean, I had lots of people working for me, but not direct technical. I had technical responsibility, but not technical oversight, mm-hmm. but not technical day-to-day responsibility. But I still did continued to do some consulting in the hazardous material mm-hmm. area also, because I wanted to do that personally. I didn't want to just, do high-level management.
So that other consulting you were doing on the side, that was your own?
No.
Okay.
No. I did that through Weston, and I had a small staff that helped me with that. Weston was a matrix organization, so technical work was done in particular, wherever that expertise resided. And I had a couple of project managers who worked with me. But I had I had a national name in that area, so I could, spend some time doing that. And I didn't charge EPA for that work. I charged my clients for that.
Who are some of your clients?
I'm not sure I'm at liberty to say.
Okay.
EPA certainly was my major client.
Okay.
And that lasted for about 9 years. Mm-hmm. And then I took over the New Jersey office.
Okay.
And I had management, because I didn't want to commute to Pennsylvania.
Westchester, PA. Yeah. So when you were doing your, I know you can't mention who you were working for as a consultant, but what were some of the type of work
okay.
you were being called on?
Sure. I had one client who had a legal problem, and had pollution problem, mm-hmm. Hazardous materials problem. The lawyer in that case was the former commissioner of New Jersey DEP, mm-hmm. and she called me in, and I provided very senior technical advice to that firm and sat with them when they sat with New Jersey DEP negotiating solutions to their problem. And then called in my people to look at various things. Mm-hmm. So it was. I don't want to use the word policy consulting, but it was certainly not. It was strategic rather than tactical. Mm-hmm. Had another client, same sort of thing. But it was all in the hazardous material.
So you're essentially trying to, if I'm understanding this correctly, solve the problems that were coming up in various industries in terms of the pollution that was coming out of them, trying to look for technical solutions to prevent. So I guess for the upstream solutions, or the beginning of the pipe solutions instead of end of the pipe solutions.
Yeah.
Okay.
But in this case, it was things that had already happened.
Right.
And trying to clean them up.
Okay. So it was cleaning up the mistakes, but were you also advising on ways in the future not to make
Yeah.
Okay.
I was doing some of that.
Okay.
But again, strategic, not
right.
tactical.
Right.
So I'm curious how that felt different than some of the work you did at EPA. You said you left EPA because you were afraid you were going to become a paper pusher. And it doesn't sound like you were pushing paper here, but there was so much organizational management that you were doing.
Wait. There were two parts of my EPA. I was a lab director.
So where you were when you left the Washington
area? I was a paper pusher in Washington.
So what was the difference?
15 people working for me doing two types of things. Oversight of the whole industrial and mining program. That is meeting with people, are they following their budgets, are they meeting deadlines, negotiating with them on goals, which were then approved by higher management.
Yeah.
That was, really oversight. And reporting to the deputy assistant administrator, who would have the control. Or spending a lot of time answering congressionals.
Yeah.
I had a staff of GS-15s who vote congressional. You get a complaint in from senator or congressman or somebody else in the government, and you had to have somebody ferret out the answers and then write a nice letter saying why you didn't do what you should have done, or maybe you should have done it anyway, or you shouldn't have done it. And I consider that paper pushing.
So even though you weren't doing a lot of the technical work, do you think your drawback to the career you ended up having throughout the late 70s into the early 90s was really because there were problems that you could solve?
That's right.
And you like to go in and do problem solving. Do you think that was part
that
of your attraction?
I've never thought of it that way, but that may be true. I never gave it a thought.
Most of us don't, right? So we just kind of end up where we are. I'm curious, too, about what other thing, we've covered now, like a decade and a half, pretty quickly. So much of what happened in your earlier life that pushed you in this direction happened outside of your career. It was these extra things you were doing for your local municipality. It was being a consultant to to the New York State EPA.
No, New York City.
New York City EPA. What were the other things that you were involved with besides just going to work every day?
Well, I was active in my temple. I was a member of the board. I was active in Boy Scouts, because my son was, and I had been in the Boy Scouts. Played tennis. But I had a very full time. I mean, full by today's standards, not full. When I see my kids and how they're busy, I wasn't busy, but I figured I was very busy.
What about continuing your commitment to the profession more broadly? You had spoken quite a bit about involvement in the AICHE in the earlier part of your career. Were you still contributing in the same way during this period?
In the
middle to late 80s to 90s?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. In the mid-70s, I wasn't.
Okay. Is there a reason why you stopped? Was it just you were too busy with other stuff?
Well, I ran for the board of directors, what was then the council, mm-hmm. twice and got defeated mm-hmm. and decided I was going to take a vacation. and then got active again in the 80s.
Okay.
And have been really very active since then.
So what is it that you started to do when you became reactive in the 80s? Were you still just Participating generally in the AICC?
No.
Or?
In the 70s, my last real commitment was chairman of the Professional Development Committee, mm-hmm. which oversaw things like professional licensing and at that time courses, all sorts of odds and ends. When I became active again, I joined, and I had been active also in some environmental things. I became active in the environmental division of AICG and eventually became its chair. I had been chair of the New Jersey section back in the 70s, but that was local. And let's see. Became very very active in our government relations efforts.
Mm-hmm.
For what reason?
I guess two reasons. One, I think it's important for a profession to be heard, to have its technical sense heard. And I was active from a Western point of view. I was with the National Association of Manufacturers. I was chair of the Solid Waste or Hazardous Waste Subcommittee of the Environmental Committee of National Manufacturers. I was active in the Environmental Committee of the Chamber of Commerce, U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So I was in this milieu from a number of senses, and I felt that it was important that engineers and scientists have their voices heard, heard little enough or not enough. And so I got involved in government relations through the environmental division.
So what did that entail? Like, what would it mean to be getting involved? Who in the government would you interact with?
Legislator and executive department. We pretty well limited ourselves at that time to the national scene. And then I became one of the chairs of the American Association of Engineering Societies. Environmental Policy Council, I think that's the name.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing it anyway as a Western employee, and I felt it was important for our societies to be heard. And what did it entail? Well, when I was chair, it was 10 meetings a year in Washington or New York. It's much slower now for mm-hmm. a number of reasons. But.
And what sorts of things did you discuss? Or who did you meet with?
Well, we discussed anything that, it went from pensions, and I was active in that area when I was on the Professional Development Committee. As a matter of fact, I wrote a pamphlet on not pensions, but benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So we discussed regulations, new statutes, improved funding for science and engineering. We wrote a piece to be added to the third Superfund bill, which never passed, which got adopted, by the way. We do interact with congressional staffs. We'd have briefings for congressional staffs, not only with AICHE, but the Founders Societies and ACS work together sometimes. So it was a broad spectrum.
So were you looking to lend your expertise on certain topics, or was this just about promotion of the profession generally?
No, it was subject related.
Mm-hmm.
promotion of the profession, if it rode along, that's fine, but that's not it. Yeah. And we weren't, we would put out technical papers. There's one on biofuels, for example. There was one on reactors.
So how did you decide what topics to...
Oh, that's a good question. That's our current board of directors argument, how we do that. There were really two ways. One, we would see what's going on in the government and see what we could lend expertise to. Or some of our members would come and say, this is an important issue for us. Should we write something on it? Because the Government Relations Committee itself did not write the papers. They were written by experts within the organization and then vetted.
I was wondering, you were involved with the AICHE for quite some time. And again, I'm just sticking to the period 80 to 93. By this point, would you say, or would you be able to characterize the ways in which, if any, the AICHE had changed over the time when you first became involved with it up to the early 90s? Was it pretty much a static organization?
There were two things. One, when I first became involved, there was an executive director, and he was really it. Mm-hmm. F.J. Van Antwerpen. And the volunteer organization and the staff were all, it was like Arnold Thackeray, you know. This place was Arnold Thackeray, right? Mm-hmm. The ICHE was F.J. Van Antwerpen. After he retired, that changed. And I think we got more volunteer involvement and direction. And the other thing I think that happened was when I joined, companies would send people. And there was a general feeling, one meeting a year. Mm-hmm. If you want to do more than that, you have to write papers or do something. So when I became active in the 60s, I went up to my boss and said, look, I'm going to need some secretarial time, and I've got to go to at least two meetings a year. I'm on the program committee. No problem. You couldn't do that today. Mm-hmm. Most people, I think, it comes out of their hides and their pocketbooks. Mm-hmm. And so the organization is much slimmer than it was in those days. We have fewer members. And I think that's true. Have you ever seen the book Bowling Alone? Mm-hmm. It's a book about not-for-profit organizations. And I started reading it because my wife was president of Legal and Bones in the United States. And they were having membership, you know. And it's just the time. And so there's a different, there's that difference. But we still carry on. And it also, I think, we used to have four meetings a year. We have two now. A lot more on e-learning and webinars and things like that. Because people don't come to meetings. Local sections used to be very active, and they're not now. It's mostly people of my age, or even older. And that's not true of all of them, but certainly. Right. You know. And getting the young people involved, Sarah, is very difficult. Because they just don't have the time. Or they have other things. The other thing that happened is, when I joined, there were two main routes. Well, three main routes, but two main ones in one for chemical engineers. There was the chemical industry and the petroleum industry, and the combination of petrochemical industry, but that's the same. And academia for some, right? Mm-hmm. When one of my guys at ESSO went to Wall Street, and this was in 1963, I couldn't understand. One of my classmates at Michigan was going to go to med school. That was an oddball. I mean, that just didn't happen, mm-hmm. you know? today, chemical engineers are in such a diverse fields that there's not that focus. And so the other question is, how do we serve our profession with that widespread of things? It was much easier then than it is now.
I guess in some ways, it's harder now to define what the profession actually is, since people
don't.
Well,
that's another way to put it.
Yeah. Okay.
We certainly don't serve you in that sense.
Right.
Now we'll even embarrass you by asking what you're doing. No, but seriously, it's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. You know, during the time that you were at Weston, you also did receive two awards, and I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about why you received them, what they were about specifically, the Cecil Award.
All right, Larry K. Cecil was probably the premier chemical engineer in water treatment.
Mm-hmm.
He was a professor University of Arizona, and an award was named for him for contributions, technical contributions, in the environmental field.
Mm-hmm.
And I received it late, but I received it for my contributions in the oil and hazardous spill area research there. It's given every year, and still given. And to somebody who's made technical contributions in the area.
So what were the technical contributions that you were...
If I remember correctly, it was for my work in oil and hazardous spill research.
Okay, so it was the research and the things coming out.
Well, the development.
Development, okay. Okay.
Research is a pretty loose term there.
You also received the Stanley Cap Award from the AAEE.
Yeah, in that's the American Association of Environmental Engineers. I was on their board.
Mm-hmm.
I was the AICHE representative on their board, like I am here. I'm not sure why I received it. And I'll be very honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember that. I was surprised that I got it. And I think it was for general contributions in the area of hazardous material.
Okay.
Can you talk about how you straddled these two worlds of getting awards for being a chemical engineer, but also getting awards for being an environmental engineer?
I was going to ask. It looks like at least now the CAP award is
environmental.
It's for board certified environmental engineers. And I was going to ask you if you actually received board certification.
I am a diplomat. I still use the old term in environmental engineering.
Okay.
That's a post professional engineering certification.
Mm-hmm.
It's now called board certified, their equivalent.
Okay.
It's by examination. I actually got it by eminence from the AICHE, was able to nominate some people.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I qualify.
Okay.
But, you know, I have to say, and maybe this is part of the problem, I'm still a chemical engineer. I practice environmental management and environmental engineering. My background is extremely well suited to that. Remember, when we look at the history of environmental engineering, it started out as a sanitary engineer who dealt with sewage. And that was an area that chemical engineers, that was beneath them. I mean, they were being petroleum and doing things. And sewage was not, garbage was not for them. But I think that changed. First of all, environment became a hot issue. But on top of that, our expertise is very much needed and serves a wonderful background to handle most environmental problems.
Why is that?
Because they're chemical, because they're process. I mean, a power plant, which mechanical engineers do, or an incinerator, is really a chemical plant in a way. It's a combustion unit. A sewage treatment plant is a chemical plant. I mean, you're treating sewage with chemicals. You're dealing with water flow and solid handling and all the things that chemical engineers do. And so chemical engineers, I think, are extremely well suited to work in this field. And it's just one of the many fields. What are we doing in in drug companies? Well, should be pharmacists, pharmacologists? No, they're chemical processes. Chemical engineers work in steel plants because they're also chemical. And metallurgical engineers work there too. But am I?
But do you think that gave you a different perspective on dealing with the sorts of environmental issues that you would have versus someone who was trained explicitly in environmental engineering?
Well, of course, when I was around, people weren't specifically trained in environmental engineering. Right.
So what? So that's another question. When those started to show up in AICHE and things like that?
Well, environmental engineering programs really started in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Before that, there were sanitary engineering programs. There was an air pollution control program. It was usually handled by chemical engineers because it dealt with fluid flow and particles. And the civils did sanitary engineering. Now, that was a special field, and they needed to get some chemical engineering-type courses, heat transfer, mass transfer, fluid flow. If you were a standard civil engineer, roads or structures, you didn't know anything about that. By the way, it's one of the anomalies in the California PE law. Civils have to sign process flow diagrams. But, I don't know whether I've really given you an answer, but what it says is that the only thing that chemical engineers didn't have that dealt with the environment was the biological aspect or the human health aspect, the toxicological aspect. And most environmental engineers don't have that either. They have maybe one course in mind. Mm-hmm. And so you pick some of this up. I mean, you don't.
So you're watching, not to jump too far ahead, but you know, you're looking back now as someone who's been involved with AICHE for a very long time.
50 plus.
A very long time. You're talking about the drop kind of overall in chemical engineers. Has there been a rise of, you know, there was a moment there when you were discussing of the overlap between the chemical engineers and the environmental engineers, and the environmental engineers really starting to take off in the 70s, but they were doing things that were previously left likely to chemical engineers. Was there a disciplinary shift?
Or they weren't used. I mean, when I started in chemical engineering, we just dump stuff into the river, you know.
Yeah.
You don't dare do that now.
Right.
That I interrupted.
Yeah. No, I guess I'm thinking too about the differences in the training, and how much of this comes back to some of your thinking where we started today's conversation around how one manages thinking about different media and how one thinks about systems and how that gets played out by these different professions and what makes you in your personal history coming in through some of these different projects able to put some of those pieces together perhaps in ways that you know maybe you didn't see other pieces.
I think that depends partly on maturity. I think a young chemical engineer or young environmental engineer comes out into the field, we'll look at a problem one way, while somebody who has been around for 10 years looks at a much broader thing. This is tactical versus strategic in the process of systems point of view. Most of us, when we were educated, were not educated in systems. Chemical engineers, to a certain degree, were. Because they overlooked the whole process. You know? and most engineers in those days were not. Now, environmental engineers equally have to look at systems and the interaction of those. So the question is, do they have a difference in education? Maybe, but not in thought process, if they're good.
So
I have very little to do with my history.
I have one question that has to do with, I guess, reflections on, you had mentioned Reagan, 1980, things changing a little bit in 1982 when Reagan realized, well, he can't do exactly what he wanted. You were working for Weston throughout the Reagan years and Bush number one years. Did you see any major transformations in governmental policies that had an impact on Weston during this period of time?
Certainly the beginning of the Weston year, Reagan years did have an impact.
Okay.
We went down in employees and type of work. In 82, Reagan didn't quite flip, but there was a different process going.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of public pressure to have continued environmental regulations from a health point of view. And Weston grew as a result.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think that public pressure was coming from? Was it things like Love Canal
Well, Love Canal, of course, by the time was already done. But there were incidents, whether they were air incidents or health incidents or oil spills. Every time you have an incident, you get public pressure. Mm-hmm. And there was enough money to do things. And on top of that, industry decided, rather than fight, they were going to join. I remember once at an AM meeting where I was sitting and we were talking about self-audit. Industry was going to audit itself. And the guy from a major oil company looked at me and said, "You consultants, it's just a consultant's benefit or a retirement plan." And I had to sort of keep my mouth shut because here I am, consultant at the National Association of Manufacturers. That wouldn't happen today. There was a change. I think industry felt that it was better to do what they could rather than fight. And that really happened in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Was that a response to anything?
Pardon?
Or what do you think that was in response to?
I think we found that economically it was economically advantageous to do some of these things. Mm. In other words, it made process and economic sense to treat and to prevent rather than to treat at the end. It made economic sense as long as the regulations were reasonable. Now, you can over-regulate it. I'm not. But as long as they were within reason and achievable, it was easier to do that than to fight. Now, not everybody. Small industries had a real problem with this because they'd be one man or one woman shows and they had to do everything, manufacturing, sales, and that was tough. But for large industries, it just made good sense.
Should we transition? You leave Weston in 93.
Hey, can we take a 5-minute break,
sure.
Guys?
Sure.
You mind?